Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the Graphic Novel Book Club, with me, Seb Patrick, and my cohort, James Hunt.
Hi.
And after we noticed the significantly more successful podcast, House to Astonish, recently nicking our gimmick of having a guest third voice on an episode, we decided to repay the favour by nicking a couple of theirs. So get ready to hear the sound of an ambulance appearing at random intervals, and for the rest of the podcast, James is going to be speaking in a Scottish accent.
Okay, the new.
We're expecting the call from CBR any day now. In the Graphic Novel Book Club, we select a trade paperback, collection or OGN each month, and in advance set 5 pre-planned questions for discussion. We invite any listeners to submit their own responses to these discussion points, as well as any other topics they may wish to bring up, and we use these to supplement our own discussion of the book's theme, story, merit and so on. If you're interested in contributing to a future episode, you'll find all the information later on.
This month we've chosen to look at Superman's Secret Identity, a 4-issue prestige format miniseries from 2004, in which a teenager from our world, coincidentally named Clark Kent, discovers that he has the powers of Superman. Written by Kurt Busiek and drawn by Stuart Immonen, the story takes place over 4 distinct time periods. The first deals with Clark's origin story, while the rest detail his relationship with Lois Chowdhury, ongoing persecution by the government, and eventual family life. Thematically, the book explores various ideas around the emergence of superheroes, from the public and political response, to the personal cost of having such abilities, ending on an optimistic note in which superhumans like Clark are commonplace in society. First impressions.
This is where we put ourselves front and centre by telling you how we first came across the book and what our initial impressions were upon first reading it. In fact, if I were going to sum it up more succinctly, I'd probably just say first impressions. That basically sums up everything you need to know about this section and doesn't really require further elaboration. So just to be clear, this is the first impressions section.
Gotcha. So Busiek and Immonen as a team, I think the first time I encountered them would have been when Immonen was a guest artist on Busiek's Avengers run.
Oh, I didn't even know that he'd done that.
Yeah, I think he did a small arc. And I know they then went on to do Shock Rockets and Superstar. I remember I read those at the time, and I mean, as a team, they clearly enjoy working with one another, but I'm not sure they necessarily had anything particularly special until this.
Mm. I didn't know them as, I mean, I don't even think I knew Stuart Immonen that well as an artist before reading this. Because I read this back when it came out in 2004,
yeah.
And then obviously read it because it was a Superman story that had an interesting concept, so I picked it up as it was coming out. And in retrospect, I've discovered subsequently that I've read other Stuart Immonen drawn things. I actually discovered quite recently, going back over some late 90s Superman stuff, that he not only drew but then went on to write a run on the Superman titles for a while.
I didn't know he wrote, actually.
Yeah, it was one of those instances where he came on to draw it and then the writer left, so I think he took over. And actually, looking back over it, you know, he has a pretty decent grasp on the character.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, since then, I've discovered artwork of his. But, you know, this was my first exposure to him, which is a pretty good exposure because I think it's still some of the best work he's done.
The thing about Kurt Busiek is pretty much everything he's done has been really good. So I'm not entirely sure why I didn't bother to get this when it came out. I have a feeling it's probably just because it was DC and I wasn't really reading anything DC back then.
Mm. Whereas I was the opposite. It was like, this is something that's going to interest me. And I probably hadn't read anywhere near as much Kurt Busiek stuff as you by that point. I mean, I think probably partly for reasons that kind of personally I like it as a favourite, but I think it's probably the best thing that I've read of his, full stop, really. Which is pretty high praise given some of the stuff that he's done. And I know there are probably things
Marvels
that you put high. No, well, I imagine we will discuss Marvels later, and obviously Marvels is brilliant, but I actually prefer this to Marvels. That's
fair enough, I suppose.
But yeah, I'm sure that topic will come up in more detail in a bit.
I mean, the thing about this that I find sort of mainly interesting is that I'm not entirely sure it's about Superman as opposed to being about the sort of platonic ideal of Superman as the superhero.
Well, again, that's a point I think I want to come on to with one of the questions that I almost kind of specifically worded to lead into that.
Is that the first question?
You know, upon reading this, I enjoyed this on 2 main levels, really, which are, one, it's a really engaging character story. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you've got hopping in on a character at 4 different stages of his life and properly developing him both during the time that we're reading and then quite clearly in between the pages as well.
Yeah.
You know, he's a likeable and engaging character, so you're invested in what happens to it. Especially because it's so small scale. I mean, the thing about this is there's no threat, you know. He's not stopping some... When I say there's no threat, I mean there's no threat to the world that he kind of has to stop or anything. You know, any threat is to him directly and pretty much nothing, and, well, you know, to his immediate family as well. So on that level, it's a really enjoyable story. And then obviously, as someone who's a fan of Superman, I just really enjoy seeing the bits and pieces of the character's mythos and background being basically taken apart and then put back together in a completely different way in order to do something different with them and look at them from a different angle.
It's kind of interesting as well to do it as four separate books, because when you read it together, it's clearly like there's a sort of novelistic approach in carrying this through his entire life. Like, I mean, well, do you think the chapters work individually as stories, or are they designed as parts? Because I'd say probably that.
I think, yeah, I mean, none of them are really self-contained stories.
Is that, well, I can read the origin. But.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, yeah, I think if you only read the first issue, I mean, the first one ends on a bit of a cliffhanger with the introduction of the Men in Black, but actually where it ends on him... you know, his final line is, whatever happens next, for the first time since I can remember, I think I'm looking forward to it. If that was the last panel, that would be a really nice little self-contained story. The other ones, not so much. They do lead into each other a bit more. Yeah. I think as self-contained chapters, they're structured superbly. But they are, the 2, 3, and 4 are more chapters of one big story.
Yeah,
whereas
it's clearly designed as you know, a big reading experience. Yeah. Not four issues that have been collected together.
If anything, I'd be interested to see what the sales patterns were like on the issues and whether there were a lot of people who read book one. And admittedly, in very small letters at the bottom, it says 1 of 4. But I just kind of wonder if there were a lot of people who bought issue one and sort of, you know,
thought that was it.
That was it, you know, yeah. Especially because this was around the time that Smallville was at its biggest. And book one is the one that's set in Kansas and is much more of an analogue with Smallville itself. So,
yeah.
Talking points.
In this section, we'll be discussing the set questions, I suppose we'd call them, for the Graphic Novel Book Club. The first question is this a story about superheroes or a story about ordinary people told with the trappings of the superhero genre?
Okay, so this question that I posed, it was sort of my way of getting across the point, or at least giving myself the opportunity to make the point, that although this book looks and feels like a superhero story, I don't think it's what you would call a superhero story in terms of its themes or its structure or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't fall into that genre or really, you know, rely on very many of the tropes. Yeah. And I think kind of what I was getting at with this was that I actually think that this story is a story that's kind of, it's about family and love and commitments and responsibility and expectations that are placed on you and living up to a life that's expected of you and basically lots of things which are part of being human. It's a really human story. But Kurt Busiek is a writer of superhero comics, and so that story that he wants to tell, instead of doing it as a novel, he's done it as a superhero comic. But I don't think that what he's trying to get across in this story is something about what it means to be a superhero, or what it's like to be a superhero, or, you know, the struggles that superheroes have to face. I don't really think that's what it's about.
No, I mean, superhero stories tend to have kind of a central idea of either sort of heroic sacrifice. And I think this is very much the opposite, in that it's about him trying to, you know, not sacrifice his life for being a hero. Like, he wants to live his life and do it sort of in an undisturbed way, you know, as kind of ideally as silently as possible for the majority of the story.
Well, there's a major thing that I think sets it apart from most superhero stories. It doesn't have a villain at all.
That's exactly what I've got written here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's okay, there are vaguely antagonists. You know, the government are an antagonist.
Yeah.
And this is what I said before when I was saying there's no threat. I mean, there is a threat to him, but he doesn't fight anybody in this story at all. You know, he probably, I doubt he throws a punch at anyone or anything in the entirety of the story. Now, actually, that kind of makes it still, to me, a bit more true to the ethos of Superman, because I think the best stories about Superman are stories about Superman rescuing people rather than Superman fighting crime. You know, there are other crime fighters, and I don't see Superman as a crime fighter. And the thing about this is, yeah, you know, there's no villain. There are no criminals. I mean, again, maybe in bits of the story, Clark probably does go and spend some of his time catching criminals, but really, he's there to stop natural disasters and train crashes and plane crashes and stuff. And, you know, even if you look at most of the best moments in the Superman movies, there's Superman catching things that are falling out of the air because no one else can do that. You know, the police can't do that, but the police can catch criminals. And that's why I think, you know, I think that's a distinction with Superman, or at least with what Superman's become over the years. And that's the thing. That's why I would say that while this isn't a superhero story, it is a story about Superman. And this is where I want to bring in a point from our regular contributor, Alex Hearn, who, as per usual, has written up responses to our questions on his blog, alexhearn.wordpress.com, in much more detail that we won't end up reading out the whole comments, so if you want to read them in full, go and read them there. But a point that he said straight off the bat was, before I think about whether this is about superheroes or not, I can answer one question. It's not about Superman. And I completely disagree with that.
It's a contentious statement, isn't it?
Because, okay, it's not about Superman the character, but it's what it is about Superman the icon. And it's not even... I mean, I don't think that Clark in this story is an analogue for Superman at all. Nothing that he does or nothing that happens to him is an analogy for anything that's happened to Superman or an attempt to... This story isn't what if Superman existed in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
This story is someone gets superpowers in a world that immediately looks at him and goes, that's Superman. you know, because Superman is an icon throughout this story. He wears a Superman costume so that people... that's one of my favourite things about the book is the reason why he wears the costume. So that people will go, I was rescued by Superman, and people will think they're crazy. It's like that, you know, that wouldn't work if he was just putting on a green costume and just being a generic superhero. It works because it's Superman.
Yeah.
And it's about Superman as an inspirational figure. And, you know, he only meets the love of his life because of... his friends playing a joke based around what they know of Superman, you know. But it's about Superman as a cultural touchstone, basically. So in that sense, I think the book is about Superman, even though, okay, it isn't really an exploration of the character of Superman.
The book is about Superman, but Superman's not a character in it.
Yeah.
Just sort of an external influence.
But it's also not even really about the character of Superman. It's about Superman in italics. It's about Superman the comic, Superman the films, Superman the franchise, kind of, you know.
I mean, the question says, is it a story about superheroes or one about ordinary people told within the genre? And I guess you can make a fair point about is, can it not be both?
Yeah. And ordinary is probably the wrong word to use because Clark isn't ordinary. But what I was getting at was what a lot of people would think of as a superhero story wouldn't be the same as a story about the problems of ordinary people. Although, I mean, a point that Alex makes, and yeah, he's right, and there are probably many more examples than he lists, that, you know, there are lots of superhero stories that are more about superheroes as people and, you know, their family problems and that kind of thing. I mean, he cites Hickman's Fantastic Four as an example, but you could probably cite any Fantastic Four comic as an example and any Spider-Man comic, really. And, yeah, there are lots.
True enough. See, I think in this one you can take the sort of... If you assume the superpowers are a metaphor, then it's quite clearly a story about someone who wants, like, the best for not just himself, but those around him as well.
Mm.
And in that sense, you know, as you say, there's no villain. He's not fighting people. He's just trying to live a good life, sort of as best he can. I mean, it's not a story about if you woke up with superpowers, what necessarily would happen. It's not that kind of idea. Like the
it's following someone in their attempt to do what we all do, which is to make the best life for ourselves and for the people who we love.
With the tools we've got, exactly.
And he just had those tools just happen to be superpowers in his case, and they bring with them good things and they bring with them massive problems as well.
I mean, again, Alex does say that it's, you know, he doesn't think there's such a genre of superhero, it's just a setting, which I think there is a genre such as superhero, but...
Mm. Yeah, because I do think there are storytelling structures.
And, yeah, exactly. There are structures and themes.
And there are story beats. And,
yeah,
you know,
that you would expect to see in something that's a superhero fiction, just as if it was, you know, noir crime or whatever.
Mm, and that's the thing, I don't think this story really has very many of those.
No.
But it does set out to look and feel a bit like a superhero story. Although even then, again, you know, I mean, kind of Immonen's art isn't really classically superhero looking.
And certainly not at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, and when Clark puts on his costume, he looks like a bloke in a Superman Halloween costume. He doesn't look like Superman.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I'm not even sure how much of the trappings of the superhero genre it has, other than having a whacking great big Superman logo on the front.
It has the costume, and it has the powers, and it has the sort of the feats of strength, I suppose. Those, you know. I mean, there are superhero ideas embedded pretty deeply in there, but... It's not about those ideas in the same way that, say, an X-Men story might be.
I would basically say the only way that it's about superheroes, as we understand super... I mean, okay, in the story he is a superhero of sorts, but he's not a superhero as we would understand it. That's why the only way I would say it's about superheroes as we understand them is that it's about the effect that fictional superheroes have on real people, you know, rather than any real superheroes and what they might be like. So sort of on that topic of putting superheroes in the real world, that sort of neatly segues into our second question. Because I've said that ostensibly, at least, the book pitches as a superheroes in the real world story. How much does this actually hold true, and how does it compare to other entries in the genre? Does Clark's world feel like the real world, or is it actually as fictional as the DC universe?
I tend to think that the world in Secret Identity is a very rose-tinted view of our world.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that necessarily says about me, but...
That's the thing. It's like, I mean, even if you look at the, you know, the copy on the back of the... And admittedly, I think we had this come up with Walking Dead. You can't always take blurb copy on the back of a comic as indicative of the intent of the author. But the way that it's written, it does very much pitch as, this is what it would be like if somebody in the real world got the powers of Superman and what he would do. And I just don't think that's what the story is about, for a couple of reasons. I mean, firstly, as we discussed in answering question one, I don't think it's the main theme of the story anyway. It's not what the story's setting out to do. It's not a great big what if. And secondly, yeah, it's not really the real world any more than Watchmen's world. I mean, whenever people say Watchmen is about superheroes in the real world, it's clear that they haven't read it.
The real world in which there is a all-powerful blue man.
And you know, hydrogen-powered cars and, you know, in 1985.
Well, in that sense, it's specfic, isn't
it? Well, yeah. But that's the point. It's specfic. It's not the real 1985. But yeah, and neither is this. It's tempting to look at it as that because it looks realistic. And I mean, realistic is a word I would definitely use. It is a realistic portrayal of how he reacts to his powers, what happens when the government discover that he exists. You know, he has to deal with stuff that superheroes in the DC universe would never have to deal with because it would make the stories, you know, a completely different kind of story. Yeah. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's an exploration of what would happen realistically, but that doesn't mean that the world that it's set in is our world, and there are a number of ways in which it's quite different. It's a world that's set up to allow this story to happen, basically.
Yeah, and I think part of what I find so sort of rose-tinted about it is it's not even just his, just the character of Clark, in that you kind of get the impression that the character of Clark couldn't really exist in the real world because there aren't enough shades of grey in there necessarily. I mean, again, I don't know if that's just me, but it seems
it's a little
like
too idealised.
Well, yeah, there's not enough temptation for sort of selfish use or anything along those lines.
Well, I mean, Alex brings up that one of the things he doesn't like is not seeing the world reacting to the first superhero or like the first costumed hero being out there. And a comparison I would make in that case would be with Kick-Ass. But that's the whole point of Kick-Ass is. Kick-Ass really is supposed to be about... I mean, even then, Kick-Ass is obviously unrealistic in a number of ways, but increasingly so as it goes on, but it is supposed to be a lot more, this is what it'd be like if someone did this in real life, and that's why we see the public reaction
I did think about mentioning Kick-Ass in saying that it's got a similar premise in that what if there was a superhero in sort of a realistic world, but then Kick-Ass doesn't try and be realistic. The world is realistic, but what happens in it is fantastical.
Yeah.
Whereas this is almost the opposite, as in it's got a fantastical element, but tries to be as realistic as possible.
And this is, I mean, Alex kind of went on about this point quite a lot, and I think it's something that was a real sticking point with him. I think his point was, if it was the real world, the reaction of the world would be so unavoidable. And that's where this comic is, in a kind of halfway place between ordinary superhero comics and something like Kick-Ass. You know, in something like Kick-Ass, the moment someone goes out on the street in a costume, they're up on YouTube and it's a sensation. In a regular superhero comic, no one bats an eyelid. This is somewhere in the middle. I mean, I think the first issue, I think, does do a pretty good exploration of, because the whole point is, you know, Clark isn't just openly out there as a superhero, you know, he's doing it in secret. And I actually like the story in book one of someone trying to wheedle this story out more, and, you know, all the rumour that flies around, and, you know, it's actually a story that, even though it's only, 8 years old, already wouldn't work if told now. It's like, you know, even now the technology is overtaken it a little bit. Although, of course, the early part of the story is set probably, 1980s, so it's a bit different, I suppose.
Could just about get away with it, I suppose. Yeah. I mean, one of the things Alex takes quite quite a lot of umbrage with, is that in our question we said it takes place ostensibly in the real world, but then even in the first book you've got these men in black turning up.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not sure I necessarily had as much of a problem with that, because I get the feeling if there was someone doing these sort of things in public, there would be
It's not like shady government agents don't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe they don't look as much like Men in Black all the time as they tend to do in films, but they do exist and they would be all over this.
I mean, they're not the Will Smith Men in Black, but yeah, they are. They're not obviously fictional in this case. They're just men in suits who look a bit sinister.
Yeah. I mean, not that I want to completely rag on all of Alex's points, because I mean, obviously he does make a lot of very good points, and we'll get to some more later, but he also doesn't like the idea of flying cars showing up at the end. He says, I wasn't quite sure if it was a Watchmen-esque look how much superpowers have changed the world thing, or just a now it is the future point. I feel it was the latter, and I do wonder whether Buzek has ever read any near-future SF before, because writing about flying cars when the scene is set, what, 20 years in the future? That just looks silly, man. I think he's doing Buzek a disservice here, because there is a specific line in the book that references the fact that the superpowers have made it possible for there to be flying cars,
yeah.
And he's amazed by their existence. So, you know, I think cut him a little slack on that one.
I do think the future, I mean, if you compare it to the likes of sort of Watchmen and Miracle Man, which, as we say, are the anchors in the genre, those are two fairly big ones.
Mm. Yeah, we haven't really discussed Miracle Man yet, but that's
we haven't been able to read it properly.
Yes, I've never read Miracle Man because it is out of print.
Yep. But yeah, this the future here is sort of, it's almost twee by comparison to those books.
Yeah.
And its optimism.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, I mean, throughout this book, really, there is an optimistic outlook on human nature, because okay, the government are obviously trying to track down and dissect Clark. Even they soften up by the end of the book.
That was one of the things that really didn't strike well with me was that by the end of it, the government's just kind of, we don't really care anymore.
Yeah.
We've given up trying.
And, you know, obviously, as we've discussed, there are no villains. The only real villain in the story actually is the reporter in the first book. And even then, while Clark doesn't really see it, I think the reader's made to feel more sympathetic for her because of the pressures that are on her. And, you know. And it comes back to what I said before about, you know, it's really, he's there to stop accidents happening to people. He's not there to stop bad people doing bad things to people. Now you can see that as a downside, but again, it's that probably ties into the fact that a lot of people don't like Superman stories because Superman stories by their nature are sort of inclined to have an optimistic outlook. I don't mind that, because if I want a pessimistic outlook on life, I'll read a Batman story. And if I want an optimistic outlook on life, I can enjoy both.
There is room for both in the genre. I mean, one of the questions you do get a lot, especially if you talk with non-comics fans, is people saying, like, why doesn't Superman just rip people's heads off? Like,
Because
that's not who he is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something you have to resolve if you're reading a story about Superman. Like, that's kind of, that is part, in a way, of what makes this a Superman story.
Yeah.
Is that he's not a psychopath.
He adheres to the Superman code.
Yeah, exactly.
But coming back to what I was saying before about why I prefer Superman stories where he is a rescuer rather than a stopper of wrongdoers. It's because, you know, I know the reason I don't like Superman so much in conflict with people is because people will always trot out the argument, Superman stories are boring because you can't really have him fight anyone because he's too powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so you do stories where what he's trying to do isn't fight someone by virtue of strength, but try to stop things from happening, and, you know, that he can't do all this. So that's where you find interesting stories.
Kind of an interesting point about superhero comics in general, is that the fight isn't supposed to be the point, is it?
No.
Like, the fight's, ideally, it's
the fight's what gets in the way.
Yeah. Like, the fight, in the end, should be predetermined. It's everything that goes on around it.
Yeah.
You made a point then about Superman as a rescuer,
and
that reminded me about All-Star Superman.
Yeah.
Which I think leads into question three, so we might as well.
Okay.
Okay. So question three is, as an exploration of the character and ethos, how does this compare with other definitive Superman stories?
Mm-hmm.
Which, to start with, All-Star Superman, you know, that's a 12-issue, pretty solidly definitive, at least in the Silver Age sense.
Yeah.
A lot of the best sequences in that are where he's rescuing people, like
yep.
the goth girl.
Yeah, on the knew that was going to be the first one you were going to mention, because that's what everyone mentions as the best scene of all Slot Superman.
Exactly, yeah.
And because that one little scene encapsulates everything that Superman is, mm-hmm. You know.
I mean, specifically, it's the ability to find this person who has, like, been abandoned by everyone else and find them and help them.
Yeah, because that's what he does. He helps people. Yeah, so exactly. Whether that's catching a falling monorail train or suddenly noticing that there's one person who needs his help at that particular moment,
mm-hmm.
then that's what Superman does. And if you are taking that as the ethos and character of Superman, then it's absolutely something that Secret Identity is completely in line with.
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's coming from... I mean, in one sense... You could say that All-Star Superman and Secret Identity are coming at it from so completely different angles, because All-Star Superman is all about the crazy scientific, you know, Superman is the best. In All-Star Superman, Superman is the best of everything. And so it goes back to that idea of, well, that means he's super intelligent, so he's invented all of this stuff. And that means he's been to all of these alien planets and brought back all of these crazy things. And that basically means that everything that he does is bigger and better than everything that ordinary people do. Now, obviously, Secret Identity absolutely is not that, because it's about a character who is... playing the role of Superman and who is an ordinary bloke, and all of his ambitions are modest and ordinary, and he just kind of wants to be ordinary and live mm-hmm. an ordinary life. But the core thing of, you know, Superman is there to catch humanity when it falls over, basically. That's what Superman is to me.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is a story that gets that. But, you know, by the same token, it's a point that can't be avoided, is the fact that this is not a book about the character of Superman. You know, it might get to the nub of the character of Superman who exists elsewhere, but it's not telling a story about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Alex says, I'm not even so sure that this is a book about Superman. It feels like it's a book about Clark Kent, a person with superhuman powers, but there's very little that I would recognise as key to the character of Superman in Kent's personality. We have his love for Lois and his need to help people, sure, but we don't have the more godlike side of him that's demonstrated in All-Star. Which is kind of making the same point that I did, but just taking a different...
yeah, I mean, I guess the question is the godlike aspect sort of a definitive part of the character, and I'd say it's probably not.
Like some people evidently consider that it is. I mean, you only go look at Superman Returns. You know, there are people who... and
Christ-like,
you know,
than godlike.
Well, same thing.
Yeah.
You know, there are plenty of Superman stories that do like to look at that angle.
Mm-hmm.
Even whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. I mean, again, that's... all of the elements that I talked about in All-Star about him doing everything bigger and being the best of everything,
yeah.
That's kind of what Whatever Happens to the Man of Tomorrow is about, because that story is what happens when that man goes away. And that's less about... I mean, you know, he doesn't really do a lot of rescuing in that story because he's a bit busy with everything else. You know, that is a conflict, that story.
Yeah.
Not that I'm saying that it's not one of the greatest, if not the greatest Superman stories, because it is. But so if you ascribe more importance to that side of things, then no, this story doesn't get into that at all. But I think there is more to Superman than that side of things that I think is a very popular perception.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point, because in, you know, being around since like the 30s, there have been a lot of different interpretations of the character, and kind of, I wouldn't say necessarily every generation applies their own feeling about what, you know, what the character means or is. But there have certainly been a lot of valid and yet simultaneously conflicting ideas about what, you know, what is the core of Superman.
Well, it's odd. I mean, no one has any trouble accepting that that's the case with Batman. but people do seem to have trouble with accepting that it's the case with Superman.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when Superman first appeared, he was a slightly stronger than most people bloke who jumped over buildings and threw criminals out of windows and that kind of thing. You know, I mean, Superman openly kills in the early stories, just like Batman does, you know. So, yeah, there are different
normally
interpretations.
Normally just foreign, isn't it, right? But it's interesting in that way. That's something that's particular, I think, to DC's superheroes mainly. Probably Captain America as well, maybe. I guess you could say any pre-Silver Age heroes have that problem. Because, I mean, the only alternative interpretations of Spider-Man you get are definitively wrong.
Yeah.
Like, you can do, if you want, you can do the kind of dark, angst-ridden conflict between spider and men.
Yeah.
But if you do, you're doing it wrong.
No, I mean, yeah, it's probably an entirely separate point, and, you know, we have already done a Spider-Man podcast, but I think Spider-Man, in terms of personality, Spider-Man is probably the most clearly defined of all superheroes. If you have to say what Spider-Man's personality is like, that is pretty much immutable. You really can't change that, because then you haven't got Spider-Man anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many of the more iconic heroes that are more about being an icon, and the actual character behind them is not necessarily what endures.
Yeah.
And actually, that point about if while I'm making points about iconography, I mean, that's why I would say this is so much a definitive story about Superman, because it's as I said earlier, it's not so much a story about Superman the character as it is about Superman the icon, you know. And there's no other character that this particular story would work with. I mean, that's kind of something we're going to come on to with question 5. But I mean, I think there's different ways to interpret what's been said about the thing that we'll come to in question 5 anyway. Mm-hmm. But what I do think is when I say that there's no way that this story could happen with another character, I mean the specific story beats of, as soon as there's a flying man rescuing people, people are going to say, that's Superman. People aren't going to go, that reminds me of that comic Booster Gold that I read once.
You know? Hey, look, it's Apollo.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, it's Captain America. You know, it is. Superman is so ingrained in the cultural identity. You know, I see so many people wearing T-shirts with the S on it in different colours.
Oh, from Topshop.
I want to ask them what their favourite Superman comic is and that kind of thing. I did it to Zack Snyder once and he was rude to me. That's another story entirely. But, you know, Superman is just the one. It's like, I mean, even, you know, at the moment, Batman is cool and Batman is culturally hip. And if you ask someone to name a comic book character, they would probably be more likely to say Batman than any other at the moment. Mm-hmm. But over the years and through the ages, if you were to ask someone to name a superhero, they would say Superman.
If you said name a man who could fly, Superman is going to be the number one answer.
Yeah.
Like, it's him, possibly Jesus.
But yeah, so in that sense, I mean, there have been very few stories that have bothered to get into Superman as a cultural artifact. Mm-hmm. And okay, this story doesn't do that as in-depth as you might think, but it's a big part of this story, and in that sense,
I guess it doesn't do it in that it doesn't labour the point of this is a Superman, this is a world where Superman exists as a cultural figure.
Mm.
It just kind of allows the influences to sort of permeate the book.
But again, I mean, that's kind of reflective of where Superman is in our culture and society. It's people aren't talking about Superman all the time because he's not especially cool or popular, but everyone knows who he is. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the S symbol, as has been said many times, is one of the most recognisable symbols in the world, behind the Mickey Mouse ears and the McDonald's arches. You know, it's just there.
It also stands for something substantially better than either of those.
Well, you know, everyone knows who Superman is, so that even while they're not particularly bothered by him, and that's actually something that, therefore, by having it bubbling in the background, the story gets across quite well. Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, one of the things I would say about this is that one of the ways I think it's definitive is that it's about Superman as an outsider from society.
Mm, yeah.
Because
that doesn't really always get covered.
No, I mean, a lot of the things are about Superman as a hero, or, you know, as this godlike figure, as we're saying. But this is about Superman wanting to sort of, you know, a lot of the book is about his struggle to kind of fit in under the radar, and to an extent he compromises his own morals just to try and get a sort of easy life out of it.
Mm.
Like, he doesn't want too much attention. I mean, that's something particular to the character of Clark Kent in this book rather than the character of Superman, and that's one of the ways in which they're different. But I think that aspect of, here is a society you don't fit into, find your place in it, you know, that's a way in which I think it's a definitive Superman work.
Yeah, it's the kind of Superman as the ultimate immigrant kind of thing, doesn't get... I mean, if anything, I think possibly the best exploration of that isn't even a Superman story either, it's The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
I guess that's interesting, actually, because that implies there's still that story to be written about Superman in comics. I mean, yeah, Cavalier and Clay obviously has it sewn up in the novels, but...
I mean, I'm sure there have been plenty of stories over the years just in the ordinary Superman series where he's angsted a bit about Krypton and that kind of thing and about finding his place. Actually, I'll tell you what, if there's any story that does it quite well, it's Superman Birthright, which also came out in 2004. 2004 was a good year for Superman stories, in my opinion. Birthright, which is so criminally overlooked. I should probably talk about this later in the recommendation section, but you know, that a lot of the early part of that is, you know, when Clark first moves to Metropolis. And actually, the thing about that is, in order that he doesn't get discovered as Superman, he has to deliberately not blend in, and he kind of deliberately has to make people not like him and not notice him and that kind of thing. And then much of the second part of the story is basically about the world completely distrusting him. You know, and I like that. I like that exploration of, he is the newcomer and the outsider. And the classic thing in the Superman story is, he shows up and starts rescuing people, so everybody loves him.
Yeah.
In Birthright, he shows up and starts rescuing people, so everyone's immediately suspicious of him because they don't know where he's come from. Which is, let's face it, quite a bit more realistic.
A bit more like what would actually happen.
So question four, does Lois work as an analogue for Lois Lane, or does she serve a different role in the story?
Okay, I mean, I think we should admit that even though we set this question, we both find it kind of difficult to answer.
Mm.
I mean, in that sense, it's good, because it's got us thinking about the work and her place in it, but it's not an easy, there's no easy answer to come up with.
I mean, at the outset, I mean, she isn't an analogue for Lois Lane at all. She doesn't serve the same role in this story that Lois Lane, other than as love interest.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't serve the same role in the stories that Lois Lane tends to serve in Superman stories. But what is she there for in this?
Well, in that sense, I think in a way she does serve the same role in that, not plot-wise, obviously, but thematically, the whole point of Lois Lane is that she represents the thing in society that Superman is connected to. Because, you reach a certain point and his parents are dead. So, you know, what's tying him to Earth and to the world when he's got the entire universe potentially to explore?
Mm.
And it's her. And in this story, again, you know, it's Lois Chowdhury, but she's the thing making him think, well, I need to keep undercover, you know, I need to toe the line so the government doesn't come after me.
But of course, I mean, I think a way in which she differs quite a lot, and again, what I'm talking about here is classic portrayal of Lois Lane. What I kind of have to ignore to make this point is the version of Lois Lane that spent 20 years being married to Superman because...
It's all right, that's what DC do.
That's what DC have done. But the problem with that version of Lois Lane, while those years tended to actually be the only ones that bothered to make any character out of her, and thus, should thus be applauded in that sense, the problem that they have is in fundamentally missing what I think Lois Lane generally serves in the Superman stories, and which I think the movies, the earlier Christopher Reeve movies did so much better, which is she represents the life that he can't have.
Yeah.
Because he can't give up being Superman in order to have a life with Lois Lane. And again, despite what the comics have tried to do, I don't think he can have a life as Superman and be married have the life settling down with Lois that he wants to. So, you know, Lois represents, he would have to give up everything in order to be with her. And essentially what you would have to do is therefore set Lois Lane above the rest of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't do that. As much as he wants to, he can't. Now, in this story, it's kind of the opposite. You know, Lois is the thing that he would sacrifice everything for.
Yeah.
And, you know, she kind of represents the fact that he tries to have and wants to have a normal life as much as possible and, you know, raise children and, you know, and the fact that his kind of being a superhero in inverted commas gets in the way of that and puts them at risk.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess the question you could ask then is why call her Lois at all if she's not supposed to be analogous to the character?
Well, I think another, because it's a key point in the story, really. Meeting Lois and falling in love with Lois represents the point where Clark stops being bothered about his name. Really. I mean, I know that once he's kind of become the superhero, it starts to become more of a joke to him anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's even, again, kind of narration that alludes to this, that, you know, he has less of a problem with, because it's a joke. All of a sudden he's sharing the joke with someone. And it wouldn't be the same if he was Clark Kent and he was married to someone who wasn't called Lois. She wouldn't be in on the joke with
him. It's also a sort of acceptance of his role then in that sense, isn't it? You know, why fight it anymore?
Yeah, so he is Clark, he is Superman, he's married to Lois.
It's working for him, so, you know, stick with it and carry on.
It's one of my favourite lines in the book, actually. And again, this sums up my point from earlier about how, you know, Superman is there in the cultural consciousness, but it doesn't mean that people read the comics or know the story. And it's when he says, you know, I've been set up with 18 Loises, 7 Lanas and a Cat Grant. And Lois says, Cat Grant? Is that someone from Superman? Beats me. My college roommate thought it was hysterical, though, so I guess so. It's like, obviously, I know exactly who Cat Grant is, but your average person, even if they've spent their entire life being given Superman birthday cards, might not necessarily know that.
Mm-hmm.
Although I suddenly wonder, given that we referred earlier to the timing of the story, if that one works out, because Cat Grant didn't show up until the 90s.
Mm.
It probably does work.
Yeah, I imagine it does, yeah.
I think it's only the Smallville. I think when he's in his 20s onwards, that's meant to be around about the time the story's set, and then everything after that's in the future.
Yeah.
And everything before that's kind of in the late 80s, early 90s.
I guess another thing you can say as well is that none of the other characters really have analogues either, do they?
No. Well, not at all.
Well, yeah.
There's kind of a sort of Perry White analogue.
Yeah.
But even then, it's like he keeps insisting on making the point, you know, he's not a reporter. Mm-hmm. He's a writer. He's not a reporter like Clark.
Yeah, so in that sense, I mean, she's definitely not an analogue because there are no others.
Well, again, I mean, you know, even as I said before, you know, he's not an analogue, really. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about this story is if you described it to someone, I think they would, at least to someone who knew their stuff, they would assume that it would follow the classic Superman story beats, but in a this-is-in-the-real-world sense.
Yeah.
And the fact that it just doesn't at all, I mean, it just isn't the same story at all, is definitely in its favour.
Okay, one of the points Alex makes is that even though, you know, the classic version of the Superman mythos is there's a love triangle between Clark, Lois and Superman, there's like, none of that in this in this story. What he says is that this aspect of Lois is entirely absent from Secret Identity. She meets and falls in love with Clark long before she even knows Superman exists, so there's no tension there.
Mm. Which, again, I mean, you know, if this was a story that was trying to follow the Superman plot beats, then that would undoubtedly happen, but
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't necessarily be something especially fun to get bogged down in, so it might well be for the best that it doesn't.
I suppose thinking about Lois's role in the other definitive Superman books, like in Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, they are married and they've settled down.
Mm.
In All Star Superman, she doesn't even, like, they never get out of that the love triangle rut, do they? Like, she just flat out doesn't believe he's Superman.
I think so. I think by the end she does.
Is she maybe in denial?
I'm not sure, because obviously Clark must be gone by the end. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Something I've read that many times.
But I mean, the classic issues are she spends the whole time flat out denying, like, good joke or whatever.
To be fair, I mean, she is probably one of the weaker elements of that.
That is a fair point, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing about her character that gets a sort of... She has definitive roles in the Superman status quo.
Problem is, she's the one character in comics more than any other, with the possible exception of Jimmy Olsen, who is defined by her relationship with another character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had a comic called Superman's Girlfriend, Lois Lane. And again, as much as, you know, there have been stories that have at least that have made Lois more strong-willed and independent. And so the character was generally pretty well written in more recent Superman comics. And she's great in the films. I mean Margot Kidder's version of Lois is terrific. But any interpretation of Lois Lane is always going to be hamstrung by the fact that she is so defined by her relationship with Superman.
I guess it always comes back to the question of, if she's so smart, how come she hasn't noticed that this guy is Superman? And I suppose there's an element of that in Secret Identity as well, isn't there? But
yeah.
It's something you can't get away from with a character who's spent so much time with Clark, but never...
Which is, yeah. I mean, again, you know, the whole thing about them getting engaged and married. Clark and Lois in the 90s DC comics were engaged before he revealed that he was Superman to her. So, you know, figure that one out.
I did like the way the TV series did it, though.
How did the TV series do it?
He proposed and she said, "Who's asking, Clark Kent or Superman?"
Oh, right. So what, it turned out that she knew?
Yeah. She figured it out.
Yeah.
From something shortly beforehand. So
in fact, I mean, as terrible as it is in so many other ways, the TV series probably does have the best version of Lois. It's like, you know, she is actually kind of more important in that, you know. Her name comes first in the title of the programme. Yeah,
fair point. I mean, the TV series did... It was a bit like... I've got the DVDs for reasons I'll go into another day. But the showrunner... I'm pretty sure I must have watched a commentary or an extra where the showrunner says how, like, that was the heart of the show, was that she wanted to concentrate on the love triangle and everything else was, you know, superfluous. That's why there are no supervillains and stuff, just generic crooks.
Although that kind of changed when it all went a bit batshit.
Well, she left after the first series, then you have H.G. Wells time travelling and stuff, and it's a bit weird.
But yeah, I mean, initially, you know, those stories were entirely told from her perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you might want to say about Terry Hatcher's acting ability, at least, you know.
I suppose, even when I think of Lois Lane, I always imagine Terry Hatcher in that role, just because that was probably my first major exposure to the character.
So that, like, that before the Reeve Kidder movies?
I suppose... I must have watched them, but I don't think she was as as prominent a character as in the TV series.
Yeah.
So, you know, whenever I think of Lois Lane, it's her who comes first to mind, even now. I mean, the Superman comics I've read, she's barely in anyway, so...
The New Adventures of Superman had that profound an effect on James Hunt.
For better or worse. Okay, question 5. How well might this concept translate to other characters, especially in light of the announced plans for a thematic sequel about Batman, which, as we've just looked up, is called Batman Creature of the Night, and follows a boy named Bruce Wainwright in a world where the Dark Knight is a comic book character, featuring artwork from John Paul Leon.
Which, you know, is a good choice of artist for something like that, although I don't know whether it should be imminent, really, because if it's a... I mean, it's you can't really look at... Well, firstly, we don't know too much about what it's going to be like.
No, and I think, imagine it'll be a while before it's out as well.
Yeah, and I deliberately use the phrase thematic sequel rather than sequel, because, you know, I don't think you can say that this is likely to just be a straightforward story of person decides to become Batman because he knows of Batman the comics character.
No.
I mean, as I've said before... The major thing that makes this story work is the fact that that Superman is so ingrained in the cultural consciousness. And as far as superheroes go, Batman is about the only other one you could do that with. I mean, you know, we don't know what form the story is going to take and how it's what it's actually going to be about and why things would happen the way that they might happen in mm-hmm. it. Alex says, you know, this concept needs actual powers to work. Without that instantaneous change, once I was normal, now I'm special, it's not the same concept. How can you just wake up to find that you're Batman? which is a fair point. Yeah. You know, I wonder whether a story in which someone decides to become a vigilante and then everyone starts calling them Batman might be it, but then you have basically got Kick-Ass again, because everyone, you know, that's a good gag in Kick-Ass, is the fact that they keep saying that he looks like Batman, because he does look like Batman.
The thing is, I always thought if you wanted to apply the sort of real-world logic to Batman, you end up with the Chris Nolan films.
Yeah, so
it's been done. Work backwards from how do we get this completely normal person to dress up like a bat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you think, you know, how could he get these gadgets and that sort of thing? And yeah, you end up with this kind of heavily practicalized vision of Batman where he's got manufacturing, you know, he's manufacturing vehicles and weapons. And it's just sort of, I'm sure that he's not, you know, Kurt Busiek's not going to be doing that.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it's a bit of a daft question, really, because we're speculating on something that we don't really know anything about. I mean, I suppose what we're really trying to get at with the question is sort of a point they've already made, which is, would this work with... I mean, the fact that they're doing this Batman thematic sequel is really just a launching pad for the question of, could this work with any other character?
Mm-hmm.
And there probably are other characters that it could sort of work with, but... You know, it's pretty ingrained in the idea of it being Superman, I think. And as I say, it's like, the story is less about guy has powers and starts to become a superhero in the real world anyway than it is guy has to put up with being compared to Superman all the time and then can actually do something about that.
I guess you could probably do it with Captain America in the sense that he's a character who's based on iconography.
Yeah, it's like if you were going to do a story where someone got superpowers and threw on a costume to resemble an existing superhero, Captain America is probably about the only other one, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Or as I mean, you know, Batman is a possibility, but because the idea that the military could decide to appropriate the iconography of Captain America from the comics,
I mean that could theoretically happen.
Put it in the real world. That's kind of, sort of, to an extent, what happens in the movie anyway. You know, Captain America is a fictional character in the movie before he's the actual character.
True enough.
It's just that it's all... Sorry, we're spoiling the movie there, but it is the best bit of the film.
Part of the thing, I think, that sets Captain America aside from the other Marvel heroes is that he's sort of pre-Silver Age.
Mm.
And I'm not sure you could do this kind of story with Spider-Man or, say, The Incredible Hulk. Just because the characters are so...
As we were saying before, the characters
strongly
are so ingrained.
Defined, yeah. Like, the Marvel secret identities tend to be, as Stan Lee famously said, two-dimensional. Oh, sorry, it was Alan Moore, yeah. As Alan Moore famously said, they are two-dimensional characters. Whereas the DC ones are one-dimensional, so it's easier to sort of transpose their essence.
If there's one thing that sums up how interchangeable, certainly the more classic DC secret identities are, it's the fact that there are so many stories in the Silver Age where Superman and Batman swap costumes and no one tells them apart. No one ever says, why is Bruce Wayne dressed up as Superman? It's just when Batman takes his mask off, he looks like Superman. That's just
like
a rule
in
Silver Age.
I'd like to see someone
try
that in the real world.
So broadly, I would say I would be extremely sceptical about the idea of a Batman-themed story along similar lines to this. But by the same token, I'm not necessarily sceptical about the ability of the creators to do it, especially seeing as the concept is his to start with. Yeah. And it's not a Watchmen 2 situation. It's not like DC have gone, right, we're going to do Batman Secret Identity, Green Lantern Secret Identity, Wonder Woman Secret Identity. You know, they're not franchising it, so...
But then, okay, assume for a second that you were going to do Spider-Man Secret Identity.
Yeah.
You would have a character who was called Peter Parker in a world where Spider-Man exists.
Mm.
So you can assume then, you can extrapolate that he is, say, he gets bullied by people who call him Spider-Man.
Mm.
So, you know, where do you take it from there? Just thinking about the logic of applying this concept to other characters. Because obviously you've got a central idea with Spider-Man that you can't get away from.
Yeah.
In that you have to do great power, great responsibility. So, I mean, again, are you stuck there? Or, you know, does he have to get superpowers for the story to continue?
Probably, because otherwise there'd be no reason for
him
to address it.
Yeah, like, exactly. Where's the, you know,
to be honest, if
the
there's
great
a,
power
if,
aspect?
If there's a story that does Secret Identity for Spider-Man, it's the current run of Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah, well, right.
Because that is it. Okay, Spider-Man isn't a fictional character, but he's a well-known and beloved character, and what you've now got is someone dressing up as him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think...
Yeah, I mean, someone who already knows him getting the relevant powers.
Yeah, I think if you were going to do a story like that, it would basically run along the same lines, but Spider-Man would be a fictional character instead of having been a real hero.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I couldn't see it as being that different from the Miles Morales story.
Yeah, so, I mean, in that sense, yeah, the concept doesn't really translate to other characters, which possibly makes the idea of a Batman one even more interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it as being a completely different beast. I mean, to be honest, I wouldn't even necessarily expect it to be any kind of thematic sequel. I'd say the only way it's a sequel is it's Kurt Busiek writing it, and it's going to be a story.
The basic idea
that it's a story set in a world where Batman is a fictional character, and then something happens.
Yes, that would be how Neil Gaiman approaches a Batman story. Batman is a fictional character, and something happens.
Listener comments.
Okay, so with the main discussion points out of the way, just to round things off, we'll just go over any other points that have occurred to us that don't otherwise fit in with the discussion topics. James, did you have anything else to get off your chest?
the only point I had, I've got left, is that I think possibly this is Kurt Busiek's definitive Superman story rather than the characters. Like, in the sense that Busiek does a specific type of story very well, and it tends to be stories about the kind of wonder and inspirational aspects of superheroes. And I think if you're going to do a Superman story about that, this is probably the best way to approach it.
Mm.
I mean, I can imagine other writers taking the same concept and coming out with a very different story.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you can imagine this being applied to other characters by the same writer, so...
I think if you gave a lot of people this concept, they would have written something with a lead character that was much more closely identifiable with Clark Kent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other than the inherent goodness, Clark here is very different from, you know, Superman Clark Kent in terms of his personality and his outlook and stuff, I think. And I think that's, you know, again, that's a good thing in the book. But, you know, it's not necessarily the natural thing you would have thought of. But again, I mean, I think that's a recurring theme of this story, is that it really, for most of the time, doesn't do what you would expect with this story.
There's no Lex Luthor Denier.
Yeah.
Which, that I think if you gave anyone this flat concept, they would come back with, there is Clark Kent in the real world, and he meets Lex Luthor in the real world, and they fight. But yeah, whereas this is completely avoids any of those tropes, almost to the point of belligerence.
Well, as I say, because at the end of the day, it's just, it's, you know, it's not It's not a superhero story, and it's not a conflict-driven story. It's very introspective, and you know, it's about people. I mean, it's just I've used the word before. It's a really human story,
mm-hmm.
And that's what I really like about it. I think there's a lot, given that it's about a bloke with superpowers. There's a lot that's very identifiable.
Yeah, I guess it is the emphasis on things like family, isn't it, and wanting to live a relatively quiet life in the face of a lot of intrusion and difficulty.
Further reading.
So in this section, we'll talk about any books that, if you liked Superman Secret Identity, you should maybe seek out, and books that are similar in style and content.
Well, I guess one of us is going to bring up Marvels, so it might as well be you.
Obviously, Marvels, that I guess, I'm not sure if it was Busick's first work. It was definitely his breakout work.
Yeah. Was it 96? No, it would have been earlier than that, because Kingdom Come was 96, yeah. And Kingdom Come was after Marvels.
It was sort of early to mid-90s.
Yeah, I think it was about 94, maybe.
And it was a kind of, it was a street-level view of the Marvel Universe that emphasised sort of the wonder and horror, in some ways, of superheroes during the Silver Age.
Yeah.
So it was the idea of a man on fire or a man with wings rescuing people.
Yeah.
Was heavily played up, and it was painted by Alex Ross.
And it's like, if you only now know Alex Ross as the guy who draws lots of variant covers for things published by Dynamite, you might not be aware of the days when Alex Ross genuinely was the single-handedly the biggest name in comics.
Yeah.
And Marvels was basically the reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause his work on that is absolutely phenomenal. But actually, it is a great story as well. Got to be one of the standout comics of the 90s. Mm-hmm. Certainly, especially one of the best Marvel were doing in that period.
Given the complete lack of creative fertility that the 90s represent in comics.
Well, a lot of my favourite comics do come from the 90s.
But that's because we have the kind of nostalgic reason of...
No, but like things like, Preacher was 90s, most of Sandman, Hitman.
Yeah.
There were a lot of very good comics in the 90s, as Starman. They were just buried under everything Image did.
Piles of crap. Even Marvel, though. Marvel, at one point, Marvel was releasing something like 120 monthly comics. Insane numbers. Like, there wasn't enough talent to go around.
Yeah. But Marvels, I mean, it's a likelihood that most people who would listen to a podcast like this will have read it, because it's just... If you're in any way interested in superhero comics, you really should.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how much it has to offer if you're not interested in superheroes, but it's, fantastic. Similar structure to this, actually, in terms of it's four books...
Mm-hmm.
And they jump through the life of the lead character, starting out as a young photographer and then jumping through the decades. I mean, the reason for that is more because it's looking at distinct eras of Marvel. So
It's more specific stories, even though, isn't it? It's not even eras necessarily.
Well, first one is the emergence of the Human Torch in Namor. Yeah. Second one is the Fantastic Four wedding, or is that the third one?
I can't remember which way round it is. I guess it must be the wedding.
Second one's the wedding, then because the wedding's the same one as the mutants. Second one is probably. Oh, I don't know. I'm getting lost.
No, I don't know. I haven't read it.
But one of them is anti-mutant prejudice at the same time as the wedding of the Fantastic Four. So you've got this great contrast between the heroes that are loved by everyone and the heroes that are hated by everyone. And then the last one is the death of Gwen Stacy. Mm-hmm. That's probably the standout issue as well.
Yeah, I think.
Because it really does just tell that story from a different angle. Even to the extent, my favourite detail of the whole thing is the fact that they found a background character in one of the panels of the Death of Gwen Stacy issue that looked enough like Phil Sheldon, the lead character of Marvels, that they redrew that panel with him in place. And it was,
Again, it's the same. It's sort of superheroes as icons.
Mm.
Not necessarily inspirational icons, but sort of larger-than-life figures.
Yeah.
I mean, that's definitely something that's similar about Marvels. And I guess... I've not read Astro City.
I read some of it years and years ago, a long time ago, actually. I borrowed the first book of someone. I remember quite enjoying it, and it struck me as one of those things now that it's like, it seems like there's a lot of it, and it doesn't all necessarily go in sequence, so it's quite difficult to just get on board. It doesn't seem to me that there's a sequence of books that just go 1, 2, 3, 4 that you can pick up and read.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but there have been that many spin-offs all set in the Astro City universe. Mm-hmm. I think the original, I remember the original first book of Astro City being great, but... That's all I've read of it, and I don't remember a lot about it.
I've not read any Astro City, but I know, like, it's only a case of not having had the time and sort of financial resources to get to it.
Mm. But that's basically, I mean, most big name comics writers at some point will do their own superhero universe using analogues of various characters, and this one's Beauty X. You know, it's got a... Is it the Samaritan? Is the Superman equivalent? Mm-hmm. And so on.
But yeah, by all accounts, it's fantastic. And, I mean, if you like Secret Identity, I would say definitely consider reading it.
Yeah. Another story that I would just quickly mention as being probably the only other major story I can think of that's about Superman without being about the character of Superman is It's a Bird by Stephen T. Siegel and Teddy Christensen. It's a kind of mostly autobiographical story about Siegel when he took over as writer on Superman and was struggling to come up with new stories. And then it also kind of deals with illness in the family and various other bits and bobs and stuff that he was dealing with at the time. It's a really introspective work, and as you can imagine with something that's got art by Teddy Christensen, it's quite distinctive looking. It did win an Eisner, I think, for the art. It's an interesting read. I mean, I'm probably damning it with faint praise here, but if you're interested enough in the character of Superman that you want to read another story about the effect that Superman the character has on somebody, then it's worth a look. And as I mentioned before, there's so many really good Superman stories that you could talk about, but as it occurred to me while we were talking about it, Superman Birthright as being something that's not coming from an entirely dissimilar place or style or tone, but which is actually about the character of Superman. Mm-hmm. That was Mark Waid and Lionel Yu's short-lived origin/reboot of Superman that DC just quietly forgot about.
It was immediately replaced by a new origin story.
But it's a great 12-issue miniseries that's available in one trade, and it's really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Recommendations?
So this is just where we'll very quickly talk about any new comics that we've enjoyed recently or have been enjoying on a regular basis.
Or in my case, hope to enjoy very soon.
This is the thing, because we're trying not to repeat ourselves on this, but I think most of the things that we've each been enjoying recently are things that we've already recommended on the podcast and are continuing to enjoy.
There's certainly a bit of a post-Christmas lull as well, isn't there?
So. Go back through old episodes, and anything that we've recommended in those, assume that they're still good, basically.
I mean, the one thing that I'm looking forward to most at the moment is that now that DMZ is finished as well, is Brian Wood's new story, which is from Dark Horse. It's going to be in the next issue of Dark Horse Presents, I think. It's called The Massive, and it's about what eco-activists might do after they've lost, in the sense that it's sort of a post-cataclysmic world, and they're trying to sort of find their place in it, and The Massive is their kind of Rainbow Warrior-style hulking ship, I imagine. The artist is Christine Donaldson, who's worked with Brian Wood before on a few things, and, I mean, as a pair of creators, they're very good, so I'm fully expecting The Massive to be essential reading. You'll hear about Brian Wood more, I imagine, very shortly.
In the meantime, a quick recommendation I'll do is The Shade. I don't think I've mentioned this yet, even when rounding up stuff from the DC relaunch, because it wasn't part of the initial wave. I think it started coming out a month after the issue ones, and it's actually a 12-part series rather than an ongoing, so it's one of the ones that handily gets around their need to have 52 ongoing books. But it's basically a sequel to James Robinson's Starman. It is almost like just having a continuation of that series, only without it having the character of Jack Knight in it. There's just something about James Robinson that when he's on that character, he's brilliant, and when he's on basically any other set of characters, he's dreadful. But whenever he's dealing with the Starman characters, he's great. He's slipped seamlessly back into his writing style. It's weird because it's a 12-part series, and it will have one continuing story through it, but it's been split into shorter arcs of three issues, which are themselves being punctuated by times past issues, which, if you've ever read the original Starman run, every so often you'd throw in an issue with a guest artist that flashed back to a different point in history with a different Starman. So issue 4 of The Shade was drawn by Darwin Cook and was a flashback story, which I haven't actually read yet because Forbidden Planet didn't have it when I went in the other day. So it was probably good. But the first three issues were drawn by Cully Hamner, and were great, even though he kind of drew The Shade to look a little bit too Wolverine-esque for my liking. He's kind of supposed to be a tall, thin, Victorian gentleman, and he looked too much like a burly hero. But he did also draw Hope O'Dare to look like Karen Gillan, so that kind of cancels it out. I was quite pleased about that one. But it's just really good. The Shade is a fantastic character. He's one of the best characters in comics around at the moment, full stop. And like I say, it's just really nice to revisit those characters and that world, even though it makes no sense as to how it fits into the new DC continuity, because Starman is so inherently based on the idea of there having been superheroes around from the 40s onwards, that to suddenly do a story in a five-year-old superhero universe doesn't fit. I'm assuming that it's all going to be shunted over to Earth 2, which they're bringing back imminently, or have already sort of brought back. I have a feeling that given that the Justice Society are going to be on Earth 2, we'll find out that Shade and Starman are on Earth 2 as well. But it's just, yeah, really good stories about a guy who was a villain and who's still not exactly a hero, but who's investigating the fact that people have been sent to kill him, and whenever he delves into his own background, it's quite interesting, and that's what he's doing at the moment. So probably won't make as much sense if you've never read Starman. So go and read Starman in its entirety, and then carry on reading The Shade.
Simple.
Yeah. Next time.
That's it for this month. For Goes to Plan, we'll probably have all the details of next month's podcast on our website, but just for you, I'm going to tell you we're planning to look at Brian Wood and Ryan Kelly's series Local. If you want to find the talking point questions for that episode or leave feedback for this one, you can do so at our website alternatecover.com, and we'll read them out in next episode.
If we like the cut of their jib.
Yeah, yeah. No abuse. No more abuse. If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, I'm at James Hunt and he's at Sir Patrick. Thanks for listening.
Bye.